You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 325.
On today's show, we talk about a dolmen burial rich with grave goods, seated burials, and ancient Egyptian quote-unquote post-it notes.
Let's dig a little deeper, and don't forget to leave as many notes as possible so future archaeologists can find them. Welcome to the show, everyone.
Hello.
All right, so we've got three news articles for you today.
Yes.
And this first one is titled, Archaeologists Discovered a 5,000-Year-Old Tomb Filled to the Brim with Ancient Treasures.
Yeah, super cool.
Yeah. So this is a 5,000-year-old stone-built dolmen, which is the name that they give these things. It's a megalithic tomb in Malaga, Spain, which is in the Andalusia region of Spain. It's reported to be about 42 feet or 12.8 meters long and is described as unusually well-preserved. So, and we actually saw one of these, I think, in Scotland or something like that. These megalithic tombs that are covered by stone and then covered by earth and things like that. But usually you have some stones at the entrance. And if you move those big old stones away, you can go into these things. But a lot of times they're just like a chamber in there. But this one is much more complicated.
Yeah, there's a lot more going on here. And now the excavation team says that the real value of this tomb is that it is in an excellent state of conservation. And when you have things that are preserved so well, that lets you reconstruct the people that live there, reconstruct their lifestyle, their beliefs, their funerary practices, all kinds of things about their life that we don't normally have access to. That's the kind of stuff that we can put back together. And this is in, you know, the southern Iberian area of Spain and during the third millennium BCE. And we just don't have many dolmens or monumental burials like this anywhere else from this time period.
Yeah, indeed. I mentioned this was complex. It was built with large upright stones, what they call orthostats, which I think is an awesome word. I don't think I'd heard that before.
Yeah.
They're said to be over 6 feet tall, and it contains multiple internal compartments, not just a single chamber, like I mentioned. So this is a complex internal structure for this thing.
Yeah. And like getting to what is really cool about this, it's the human remains that are found inside and also the grave goods. So they have bones from multiple individuals and they're calling these like prestigious burial deposits, as in these people might have been higher status, higher class. For some reason, they had more grave goods. And some of those grave goods include ivory and amber, seashells, and high-end flint tools, which would include arrowheads, large blades. And one of them is an exceptionally well-preserved an example of a halberd, which is an axe-like weapon.
Yeah.
So lots of cool stuff here. I think the seashells in particular are really interesting because we're not on the ocean here. So somebody brought those there.
Yeah, the seashells are indicative of long-distance trade. You know, anytime you find those in a place where they don't necessarily belong, chances are the people that live there didn't go out and get those, but they would have traded for them.
Yeah, and in a society like this that is young, you know, but complex, when you find evidence of this kind of travel and trade and effort going into getting certain things and then choosing to bury those things with a person, it just shows how complex this society was getting and how important it was, the trade networks that they had going on. So I just think that that is probably one of the most interesting pieces about this burial dolmen.
And seashells, as a side note, have been traded as basically currency, if you want to put a modern term on it, all over the world. So anywhere, I mean, we have a lot less coastline than we do interior land, obviously, in the world. And seashells aren't just found on the coastline, though. If you know a little bit about geology, they can be found in other places. But that being said, like the nice, fresh, shiny seashells that you can find on coastlines, those are unique to people on the inland, and they want to make things out of it, and they will, you know, trade for these items.
Yeah, I think it can be like sometimes jewelry, sometimes something decorative, but it also can be almost like a currency too.
Yeah. So across multiple seasons of excavation, the team identified multiple ossuaries, and that's just basically a place where human remains are kept, whether that's cremated, not cremated, or just bones, whatever. It's human mm-hmm. remains.
Well, ossuary typically refers to bones specifically.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also container rooms, suggesting that this functioned as a collective burial site rather than an individual tomb. So that's also interesting. This yeah. is more of a, like another article we're going to talk about later, more of a necropolis almost.
Yeah, totally. It's yeah. interesting too. And I wonder how broad the time period is that they were using this as a burial area, if it covered multiple generations or if it's sort of one large deposit. They don't seem to mention that in the article, but it mm-hmm. would be interesting to know if it became like almost like a family tomb kind of a thing, right. you know. I guess they need to do DNA research and all those other things.
Yeah.
So to learn how these people were related to each other, which I'm sure is something they're going to do at some point. But
yeah, for sure. Yeah. As I mentioned, this was covered with stones at the entrance, but more specifically, it had large horizontal stone slabs across the entrance. And then it was topped by a tumulus or a constructed mound. And that mm-hmm. mound is made of sand and small stones. So basically they probably dug the whole thing out, mm-hmm. covered it in stones, and then covered it with dirt to basically hide it and protect it.
Yeah, that like would allow it to blend back into the landscape. And unless yeah. you knew it was there or you came right up on it, you might not even know it's there. If you check the picture, you see a good image of yeah. it in the very beginning where you can really see how built up it is and how the entrance is not exactly hidden, but it's just not the kind of thing that you would know marks the entrance to a burial chamber, you know?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
So situated in the broader context of Europe, dolmens like this are found basically all over the place. They can serve roles beyond just simple burial sites too, mm-hmm. or complex burial sites in this case. They can be involved in ritual, of course, which is our favorite word. They can just be shelter mm-hmm. in some cases, or maybe a combination. And they can also be territorial markers because they're very prominent on the landscape, which begs me to wonder, how the hell has this thing gone so long without being discovered? Like, where was yeah. this on the landscape locally specifically that nobody knew what it was or where it was?
Yeah. And we didn't mention, but this is a Popular Mechanics article, your favorite.
I mean, these guys only talk about popular things. So.
Right. And we're definitely missing some of the context of this discovery, how it happened, why they were excavating here and stuff like that. And it would be interesting to know that, because it might be that everybody knew it was there. Mm-hmm. The local people, even the local scientists or archaeologists knew it was there, but didn't have the money or the time or the resources to get that excavation done. And honestly, if you can't do it right, it's really best to just leave it in situ until you can do it right, or you need to for whatever reason, you know?
Yeah.
So that might be why it hasn't been excavated until now.
Did we find this article, or did one of our listeners send this in? I just remember one of our listeners saying,
they might have.
I know how you love Popular Mechanics. Here's a great article. And I can't remember if this was the article or not.
You should go check your email.
I really should go check. Anyway, if this was one of the listeners, thank you for that. But otherwise, you can always send us an email. Our contact info is yeah. in the show notes. And if you found something you like, I mean, this is why we're here, is to talk about the things that you find or could find
yep.
in the news today. So,
and to be clear, Chris loves Popular Mechanics.
Rachel loves Unpopular Mechanics.
Would not say that I love them.
She doesn't think mechanics can or should be popular.
Yeah.
They're functional.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, no that's fine. They're just, I just don't know. I don't understand why all of a sudden they're in the like archaeology news reporting world.
Everybody
like,
is. That's the whole point of the show, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You see the weirdest outlets just reporting stuff because they're trying to get clicks.
Yeah.
You know, I think we're going to start reporting on the new cars coming out next year.
Yeah.
That's what we're going to start doing.
Right.
Yeah.
It's all about clicks.
It's all about the clicks.
Yeah.
All right.
So it's very interesting
well,
how that works.
We like clicks too. Go to our website at arcpodnet.com. Go click on the shop icon at the top of the page, because we have a new digital store alongside our TeePublic store, which is basically where you can get shirts and hats and coffee mugs and stuff like that. But we now have a digital download store. We're going to be adding a lot more stuff to that, but you can download a package or individual images for your smartphone backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they're super cheap. They're like, I think 99 cents US
yeah.
or $1.99 for a package of them. It's just better to get the package because you get more. So that's why we did that.
There's a couple really cool ones too. Like I yeah. love that image of the stone tool that
yeah.
is one of them. That one is my favorite, definitely.
I know. I've tried to direct our team of volunteers that are kind of helping put this together, that I want seasonal things as well.
Here's our
spring package focused
right.
around archaeology. Here's our summer package, right? So
yeah.
you can come back more often and see new things. So, and we're going to be putting a lot more I guess, digital products up, so to speak. So, all right. Well, let's go to, and I just mentioned this earlier in this segment, we have another article about burials, basically. Yeah. And this one is super interesting. So we'll talk about that on the other side of the break. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 325. And this next article is titled Ancient Skeletons Sitting Upright Found at French School.
I know, so cool.
Yeah, it's from USA Today. So again, stay in your lane, USA Today. It's not French today. So, or France today, I should say.
That's true, but USA Today like feels like they should have
they're a more traditional news outlet.
They would have a broader
unlike topics. Popular Mechanics, which should only talk about popular things that are mechanical. Right. Yes. Every issue should have something about Tesla in it, for example. Right. Yeah. Whether you like Tesla or SpaceX or not, it doesn't matter. They're popular. So anyway, so what did these guys find? Well, archaeologists excavating at the Josephine Baker School in Dijon, which is about 200 miles from Paris, found five human skeletons buried upright in a seated position, which is super crazy. Mm-hmm. The discovery was announced on March 18th in a release from France's National Institute for Preventive Archaeological Research. Is that right? Preventive? Yeah. That's our notes.
I think preventive is the word that they use in Europe when they're talking about like CRM, basically.
Yeah, I've seen that. That's probably just a translation from the French actual
term. Exactly. Yeah.
So we would say preservation or something like that, but they mean the same thing, I guess.
Yep.
I didn't notice that when we took the notes down.
Yeah. So these burials, I mean, that's so unique to be in a seated position, right?
And there's lots of pictures in the article.
There are lots of pictures. And the photos show these individuals sitting on their backsides, heads down, legs crossed, which is such a very specific position, right?
Yep.
And each body appears to have been placed in a very similar way, and that is seated at the bottom of a pit with their back against the eastern wall facing west. Mm-hmm. And their arms are sort of down along the torso with their hands near their pelvis or femurs. Sort of like hands in their lap, basically.
Yeah, they look like mob heads.
Yeah, it's so crazy,
like,
right?
These people were put in their own grave and then executed.
Yeah.
That's what it looks like.
Like, come on, guys, sit down, crisscross applesauce. Right. And then
It's just
crazy.
Crazy. Mm-hmm. Researchers think that the seated burials could date to the Second Iron Age because there's a Blackstone armband that dated to roughly 300 to 200 BCE, which I guess is the Second Iron Age in that time period. Mm-hmm. And it was the only notable object found with the remains. And that helps link them to Gaelic period burials in this area.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now you might be wondering, how did these people die? And was it all the same way? Did that contribute to why they were positioned in the same way? And what we do know is that at least five of the individuals show unhealed trauma consistent with violence. And some of these include cuts on the humerus, suggesting intentional killing, although a cut on an arm, I'm not sure how that is going to kill somebody, but okay, sure. And one skull had a blunt force injury from a sharp object. But of course, we don't know the specific weapon without it being buried right next to them.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that is interesting. The unhealed part, I think, is what is most interesting because that means that they died immediately. Whatever injuries were, they didn't have time to start healing, and the body starts healing almost immediately. Right. Yeah. So there would be some evidence in the bones of healing if their body had had time to do that. And they didn't.
Yeah. We see that all the time. And we've talked about it numerous times when we see or talk about a burial with some sort of trauma, you can see evidence of healing, which that's where the article changes from, oh, we found a bunch of crazy, weird dead people buried in a weird way, to look at this evidence of ancient surgery or care practices or something like that.
Yes.
When you see extensive healing.
Exactly.
Yeah, because somebody was taking care of this person.
Yep.
I mean, whether they were doing it to torture them or not, we don't really know. But, you know, either way, they were kept alive as long as possible.
Like we talked about in the last episode.
Yeah.
I think there's something to be learned from both different ways, both somebody healing and people taking care of them and people like this who probably died pretty instantaneously. And then my next question with these ones in particular becomes, okay, they had these injuries. Were they fatal injuries?
Yeah.
The blunt force trauma one, probably. Like, it's hard to survive a head injury like that.
Yeah.
But the cuts to the humerus, I'm like, is that all of the trauma on that skeleton?
Or was it torture?
Was it torture?
Yeah.
Then how did the person actually die if they weren't fatal injuries?
Right.
And then my mind immediately goes to, like, were they put into this pit, crisscross applesauce, and then like buried alive? Probably not, because the person probably would have tried to move and then they wouldn't be in this position anymore. Right. But that's the kind of things that run through my head. Like, how did they actually die in that case?
I know, it's crazy.
Yeah.
And we would see probably evidence of this, of some other thing, because the burial structures are very well preserved.
Yeah.
Through here. There's been some erosion because it's, I mean, there's basically a city built over the top of this right now. Mm-hmm. There's been some erosion and it's displaced or destroyed some of the more shallowly buried bones. So now they did find other burials on site too.
Yeah.
The team uncovered a children's necropolis dating to the Gallo-Roman period, including about 20 infants who likely died before age one. And this dated to the first century AD. That's when that time period is. The necropolis's edges are unclear because later activity, like planting pits, ditches, agriculture, have damaged multiple tombs. Like I said, there's a huge city on top of this.
Yeah,
so there's been a lot of work. People have probably dug through and been like, oh, crap, here's some bones. Yeah. I don't know if I'm going to mention this. And, you know.
True. And like if they're infant bones, they might not have even known what they were seeing, because infant bones are...
Could look like chicken bones.
Yeah, exactly. They're so small. You know, there's a lot of cartilage in babies still. Yeah. Things haven't fused properly. So you have these disparate chunks of bone that might not even look like they're human, you know?
And keep in mind, this was a hard period to live in. And this doesn't mean that there was some nefarious thing about killing babies
back then.
They just, a lot of babies didn't make it past the age of one.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, there's a lot of cultures that don't even name kids till they're like two or three.
Yeah. And that comes from, like, at this time period, infant mortality just would have been quite high. So it makes sense. And also, it's possible they had some kind of disease go through the population. And that always takes out the youngest and the oldest, right? And this might just be where they buried the youngest, if that did happen. Again, there's no evidence of that. They don't they don't really say how the babies die, just that they they were in the necropolis.
Yeah, they could do some, and probably are doing some further research on the skeletal remains. If they know the quantity, they have them isolated somewhat, or at least they've done a minimum number of individuals count on the bones. And you can do that kind of stuff by saying, oh, well, you know, these bones are all jumbled up, but there's 20 skulls. Mm-hmm. So there's probably 20 people here. But so you take a unique bone that they'll only have one of, or something like that. And then also they can, and like I said, probably will do these studies. If you have bones, you have DNA.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're not fossilized.
Right.
So they can do these studies. They can probably find some, if they're very far apart in time, they might see that from genetic drift, but also they can do carbon dating on these things as well.
Yeah.
So, and I don't know what the policies around carbon dating human remains is in this area, but
yeah, because they don't really put a good date on this. And so it's entirely possible that this is just where infants were buried across several generations. And then 20 infant deaths doesn't become anything super crazy. It's just where they put infants when they died over a long period of time.
Yeah,
so,
for sure. The area of Dijon has produced similar discoveries recently. In 2024, archaeologists found 13 Gauls buried seated upright.
Again, seated. That's so crazy.
They were reported to have been exclusively men, generally healthy, aged 40 to 60, with skeletal markers suggesting physical activity. So what's the deal there?
And those guys didn't die from violence, it sounds like.
Right.
So maybe they served a different purpose. I mean, we can't rule out the R word. Ritual, right? Like, it's possible that strong men who pass away for whatever reason become some sort of like a guardian of the necropolis. And that's why they're buried this way.
Yeah.
Or something else like that, you know? Again, no evidence for that, just speculation. But this is what is so great about these articles, is speculating about this kind of stuff, because we don't know.
Right. Yeah. Seated burials are pretty rare around the world. They just don't happen very often.
Mm-hmm.
But there are examples of this from the Mesolithic on through the what they call the proto-historic period, you know, for a couple of thousand years. Mm-hmm. But researchers still don't really know why people were buried this way.
It's crazy we don't have a better idea if they went all the way up to the proto-historic period, though. Yeah. I mean, you would think some kind of story would be handed down that would give us insight into this. And it might not be anything special. It might just be because they wanted to, you know, because somebody decided to do it and it just became their tradition, you know? Yeah.
And they mentioned Gauls in the article, the Gauls, that's a people in France. They're basically Celtic people, which they're known as in the UK that live in France. Same sort of cultural
references. Gotcha.
Yeah. They're just in France.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. Well, that's it for that one. Let's go on to our next segment, where we're going to talk about a bunch of Egyptian post-it notes and what was written on them back in a minute. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 325. And This article is called What Archaeologists Found Written on Those 43,000 Egyptian Notes and Receipts. So I know you found this one and we're kind of into it. So
I did. And what's funny about it is this is another one where I found it in Vice, which is like not my normal news source, right, especially not for this kind of stuff. But, you know, the article grabbed my attention and I read it and we were going to just include it. But I did end up searching it out to find more information about these notes because the Vice article was pretty sparse as far as actual details. And I found a better article on phys.org. So we've got both of them linked in the show notes if you want to read and kind of see our process where we started with the Vice article and then we found the phys.org article and kind of filled in some of the blanks from there. So,
indeed.
And the main thing, the main reason I'm talking about that is because stuff just gets lost in translation when you go from a more science focused media source to a less science focused one like Vice. So in the phys.org article, they call the little pieces, we're going to get to these notes, but the notes were written on pieces of pottery. Mm. And pieces of pottery are called
sherds.
Sherds. S-H-E-R-D-S. Yes. Now, you know that if you're an archaeologist. You don't know that at all if you're just in the broader population, which is why we try to share this stuff. And in the Vice article, they call them shards, S-H-A-R-D. Now, a shard is glass. That's what you use the word shard for. Sherd, S-H-E-R-D, is for ceramics.
Yeah, so people get that wrong all the time.
They get it wrong all the time. And news sources get it wrong all the time because they just don't have the technical expertise to understand the difference between those words. And so when you're reading articles, look for stuff like that. If you see that they've used the wrong word, don't be skeptical. Just like maybe reach out and try to find more information, which is exactly what I did. Yeah. I saw the word shard and I was like, guys, how much research did you really do here?
It's not going to fly.
You didn't even get the right word. So anyway, just a little insight into what we're doing when we're kind of vetting and looking at these articles. Yeah. Okay, so on to the actual article. This is a joint mission by the University of Tübingen and Egypt's Ministry of Tourism and Antiquities, and they uncovered 43,000 or more ostraca at the site of Athribis. And this is the largest find ever, and it even surpasses a large site called Deir el Medina. So huge. And ostraca are these little notes. That's what they call these. They're inscribed pottery fragments that were used for everyday writing, notes, lists, accounts, practice texts, whatever. That's what those are.
Yep. Over 42,000 shards were found in just the last 8 years, as you mentioned, with ongoing excavations since 2005.
Yeah.
So they've been there for a while.
Yeah, totally.
Athribis, which is this area, was a major religious and urban center, and it included a temple complex, settlement, necropolis, and quarries, and was dedicated to the lion goddess Ta-Ribbit.
I just love that. I've never heard of this site.
Yeah.
But it sounds like it was absolutely gigantic and really important to the area.
Yeah, and these span over 1,000 years from the 3rd century BCE all the way up until the 9th and 11th centuries AD. So, you know, less than 1,000 years ago.
That's a millennia. Like, that is so much time. That's just crazy.
Yeah, there's tax receipts and Arabic inscriptions and all kinds of stuff. The early ones are in Demotic script, which is the early Egyptian script.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get into the Arabic scripts later on.
Yeah, totally. Now, the site also includes 130 plus horoscope texts, making it a key source for studying ancient astronomy and astrology as well. And the excavations uncovered not just these sherds, but also buildings, living quarters, and storage areas, indicating that this was a broader settlement that was going on here and that it was occupied for a very long time also.
Yeah, now scientists and archaeologists get pretty excited about a site like this just because of the wealth of information, but also presents its own challenges. Mm-hmm. First off, the cataloging of all this stuff, it has to be properly documented, digitized in most cases, so you can have a record of it digitally so you can do other analysis on it, but also so it can be shared if need be. But it's just the amount of lab work involved in a site
so
like this.
So much work.
Yeah, they say with big excavations, I've heard different metrics, especially for like CRM and stuff, is that, you know, like a week of field work equates to several months of lab work sometimes, depending on the site.
Yep.
And we've worked on sites like that where you're just pulling out artifact after artifact.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I remembered that because we would do these excavations over the summer and then do the lab work in the winter, and like one site from over the summer with a couple weeks of field work, and you would work on that all winter long.
Yeah.
Cause it's not just like, it's not just analyzing the find, but you have to like properly document it and get it into a collection in a way that is preserving it. And then also making it accessible to future researchers as well. It's just, it's a lot of work.
This is often the most expensive part of the tube just because of the time involved. You know, people are paid by the hour typically. So, you know, there's a lot of hours involved in this lab work process. And you might wonder too, when you read some of these articles, you're like, oh, well, it's, you know, March of 2026. Why am I hearing about an excavation that happened a year ago or more or something like that? Well, because unless the site is in a really popular area or it's already a popular site or something like that, archaeologists don't generally do press releases. So you wait for the paper to come out for somebody to pick that up. And that paper is a result of the excavations, all the lab work, and then an analysis, and then you write up the paper.
Yeah.
If it's a really big multi-year effort, you might write a paper every year and just talk about one aspect of it. But this still takes an incredibly long amount of time, and they simply just can't write the paper until all that's done.
Yeah. And you might be limited by the field season too. Like whatever country you're working in has different rules around what happens with their artifacts, right?
Right.
So for example, when I was working in Peru, you can't take anything out of Peru with you. Obviously, most countries, I don't think, allow you to remove any artifacts these days.
It means you got to go back there.
Yeah. So you have to either stay there beyond the field season. And if it's a university doing this work, well, they're bound by the summer schedule, right? Like their summer vacation, they have to be back to school in the fall. So when I was working in Peru, we would do field work in the summer, and there would also be a lab contingent there as well, working on either the finds as we pulled stuff out or the stuff from the previous season, depending on what was found. So like, you're really like bound by the restrictions of time when you're doing this kind of work too. So
yeah.
Now a bigger project like this, maybe they have like, you know, budget to keep going with lab work beyond the university field season, but that was just my experience in Peru. So
yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why it's nice in this day and age for more sophisticated excavations. There are quite a few field digital recording techniques where you can do a little bit of whether it's photogrammetry, which is taking a number of photos and then producing a 3D image out of that photo or that set of photos, or even some other analytical techniques that can help you do that. Because like you said, these are getting cataloged and chucked in a box and then they're going to be analyzed later. But in the meantime, you've got the digital copies, which you can take out of the country. And you can analyze those in the off season in a little more limited sense. But with AI, which they talk about using AI tools to do some of the analysis here, that AI often just needs images, right? And maybe some really clear 3D models and things like that. But that stuff can be produced in the field. It still takes some effort, but it's going to dramatically decrease the amount of time it takes to produce a quality report for these things. So.
Yeah, totally. And just really quick before we sign off here, the archaeological complex of Athrebis, it's located 10 kilometers west of the Nile, and it's directly opposite from the ancient metropolis of Akhmim. And that is a lot of Egyptian words that might not make a whole lot of sense. That's how it was for me too. But it is just in that area of the Nile where we have tons of people living, you know, millennia ago, right?
Yeah.
And I was shocked that I hadn't heard of this place, but Egypt was huge. There's tons of places there that we haven't heard of. But I thought that this was the perfect opportunity for us to do a Strat Chat episode.
Yeah.
Because I started doing a little bit of a deep dive on Athrebis to add on to this episode, which we have been doing, you know, trying to like feed in a little bit more information about these places that we're talking about. But there's so much.
Dig a little deeper.
Dig a little deeper, right? But there's so much about this site out there, and it was occupied for such a long period of time by different groups of people. I was like, okay, this has to be a Strat Chat episode. So we're not going to give you too much more information about Athrebis itself. Just put a pin in that, and we are going to come back at you with a Strat Chat episode about it. Probably in the next episode, but you know, give us a week or two, because those take a little bit more research and a little more time. So it'll be coming soon though, where we will talk more about that site and that town and that place and that people and those cultures.
There you go.
Yep.
All right. Well, that's it for this week. Do be sure to go check out archpodnet.com/shop, and you can check out all of our digital products now. Help support the APN by downloading some of these things, and please don't share them. Just direct somebody else to. They're very cheap.
Yeah.
Very affordable.
Super cheap.
Yeah. I mean, they're digital products, so we didn't want to charge a lot, but we do have to keep the lights on over here. So we would appreciate that. And share and like and subscribe. Oh, there you go. We got to be YouTubers.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. See you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.arcpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.